Hi, Rocketeers. I'm Karen Tongson, filling in for Guy Branum, who's deep in the trenches of the writer's room. And welcome to Pop Rocket, weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell-Gorbaugh.
Hello, hello, KT!
Hey, Winter. Nice to see you again.
It's always just wonderful to see you.
We're here, and it's so lovely because right now it doesn't get dark too early.
I know. It doesn't feel like we're chasing light.
It's true. We're in the light. It's like springtime is around the corner.
No, it's springtime's here.
It's here.
Yeah.
It's here for sure.
You mean summer.
Oh, it's true. Summer, spring, who can knows? Because they make us sit in this little dark box to talk
to
each other.
So I like having light. Thank you. Well, thank you, sun.
Lest you believe that it's just Winter and me, you are wrong. Because we have a very special guest tonight. And that is Tin Nguyen, who is a food writer, one of the preeminent creators behind Rogue 99, a yearly list of essential LA restaurants.
Woo!
And Tin is here because she's also a huge Killing Eve fan, but we'll get to that in a little bit. Tin, tell our listeners what they should know about you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm really happy you're here because you know about food and Killing Eve, which is the two things we're interested in today.
And those two things sometimes overlap.
Yeah. So.
Definitely.
What else you should know about me? Well, I co-wrote two cookbooks, one with Roy Choi called LA Sun, another one with Adam Fleischman called Flavor Bombs.
Flavor Bombs.
Yeah, it's about umami ingredients and how to use them.
Ooh.
And and the Rogue 99 was just published on LA Taco about a week and a half ago. Cool. And it's Catherine Spires and I. We put it together.
A friend of Pop Rocket, Catherine
That's right.
Spires.
She was here. Yep. We put it together. It's a list of restaurants we consider essential to Los Angeles, like restaurants that tell you something about LA, that when you go there, you learn something about LA, whether through the food or the ambiance or its history. Like there's something about that restaurant that helps you understand the city, the limits of the city, the geographical region of LA County. So it's just 99 essential restaurants that we like.
Well, so I know we're talking a little bit about food right now, but actually coming up on this week's show, one of the reasons we have Tin here is because we're going to be talking about Killing Eve.
Yes.
Killing Eve has just returned to BBC America and now AMC. And we're kind of contextualize Killing Eve around the question of spies and spycraft and what makes Sandra Oh's character, in particular Eve Pilastri, like a unique spy amongst the many spies in popular culture. And of course, we're going to be sharing our latest jams. But before we find out what arts and entertainment news we're all about this week, it's that time of year. As we announced at the beginning of 2019.
Erstwhile.
The Pop Rocket seal of approval, now besmirched by the last. We've been having many issues with this because our last
it's
awardee.
It's like the Blockbuster Awards.
It's true. Like, no.
Is it destined to live on in infamy or not?
Again, who knows? But it's, so, you know, Terry Crews was the last recipient, and you know that these are for life. We cannot revoke them. But as we announced in the new year, we're coming along the quarterly competition for the next Pop Rocket Seal of Approval awardee. And the next official ceremony is going to take place next month in May. But the nomination process is officially open now, and it's slightly different. As we mentioned the last time we discussed this, you now have to nominate a candidate by calling in within the next couple of weeks here. So now that we've announced it, you have 2 weeks to call Guy's mom at 530-237-4108 and tell us who you think deserves it and why. And perhaps think really deeply about this, because I don't know that we can weather another PRSOA controversy.
I can't deal with it.
Well, so first let me ask our guest, Tin, here. Who would it be that you would be tempted to nominate and why? Winter, let's talk about that a little bit. Let's pause. Again, I'm out of order here. Parliament is out of order. So this quarter, we're explicitly asking everyone to submit PRSOA nominations for veterans with a stellar body of work who have yet to be recognized or appreciated as much as they should be. So nobody like hugely legendary like your Meryl Streeps, and also no neophytes Again, I don't want to talk about the Rachel Bloom controversy, but and you know how I felt about that.
I feel like it needs to be somebody, just like Karen says, who was not recognized on a, you know,
a ubiquitous universal scale
for like critical acclaim, who's done substantial, important, comedic, dramatic, horrific, whatever type of work they've done, but it's left a lasting legacy and impact and imprint on pop culture.
Or a huge game-changing
impact. Yes, a game-changing impact.
Tina Turner was our first awardee, not yet besmirched.
No, thank God.
It took us a while to get there. I mean, look, she has received Grammys and other accolades and other awards, but...
But she also had the respect for oneself to say, you know what? I'm going to give you the show concert tour of my life, and then bye-bye.
Yeah, yeah.
And that also takes a certain amount of willful self-awareness to be like, and I'm done.
Yeah, right. And somebody like Terry Crews, one of the rationales for him was really about like being a stalwart, like person who enhanced every like production they were in.
The taste of power.
And then damn Twitter. Once he accepted our award and did so
and
on the phone.
And then he fell.
Oh my God. Anyway, who do you think, given those criteria, you would nominate?
Okay, well, I think the right answer, obviously, is Sandra Oh.
Of course, yes.
Right? I'm going to say yes.
Yes.
That is the right answer. So I'm going to call it in, and obviously everyone should, you know, second, third, since we're talking about Parliament, fourth, fifth, that vote.
Yeah.
I think if you've been following Sandra Oh in general, you know that she's more than earned this and deserves it and has been overlooked in more ways that you can just, she's been overlooked her entire career 100%. Until very recently.
Yeah.
So, yes, I think she deserves it. Don't overlook her.
So, I know we're going to talk about Sandra Oh a little more.
Yes.
And we're going to hear more deeply about Tin's relationship to Sandra Oh in a kind of a televisual sense.
Okay, because that sounded like...
No, I know it sounded some other like, relationship. Like, well, you know, we can just leave people dangling and insinuate that. But now I'm going to get us to our all-abouts because, you know, we can't just be all about Sandra Oh this week or Killing Eve. I'm sure we've all indulged in other things.
Yes.
So as the veteran in the room, Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh, what are you all about this week?
I'm actually all about Joe Bob Briggs. I'm glad you asked. Joe Bob Briggs is a remarkable sort of pop culture figure that was, if you like schlocky, you know, poorly produced, no story having slasher movies, you know, exploitation films like myself, then you stayed up late and watched those, you know, movie shows where they always had somebody, you know, bumping in and out of the movie. He was like an Elvira.
So like a host.
An interstitial host, but he was like an Elvira, but he was more, he's like a cowboy, southern type dude who's very into film, mostly schlocky films. He has his own rating system. He would tell you how many breasts are in it, how many times people's heads get ripped off, everything.
Where do we find Joe Bob Briggs?
He now is on Shudder. It's a horror network.
You're not ordering it.
Tim does not like horror movies. The show is called The Last Drive, because he's ostensibly the last guy to be out here still kind of interested in these type of films and interested in this type of commentary. And he's, so far there's 4 episodes where he is essentially your host and narrator through the film. They take a little break after about 30-45 minutes and he stops by for like a telethon length of time, like 2 minutes, and sort of gives you like, so now you've seen da-da-da-da and this is the first part and da-da. And it's so funny. And I introduced Alan to it because Alan just thought he was, you know, Alan's from the South, so he just needed some more of his people around him. But we were laughing at it because, you know, the films that he's chosen aren't the best film. The first one we watched was Chud. Chud is a terrible movie.
Arguably not the best, but the best.
But the thing that I like about it is that he explains to them like the reason why the cast is the cast. And he explains why, you know, they were all theater kids. He's like, let's just go make a horror movie in between doing drugs and trying to be taken seriously. And he colors the movie itself in such a different way once you watch it because his knowledge of it. And the next film we watched was Cube. a Larry Cohen film, and Larry Cohen just recently died, and just his explanation on things, you know, he has a real tendency to sort of pay homage to films, horror films that were set and filmed in New York in the late 70s, early 80s, and just using New York as the environment because Manhattan was so disgusting. So it's like he likes to kind of harp on that. He's really funny. He's still a little bit misogynistic because he's always got like a big titty girl sitting next to him with her titties full out.
Well, like if he
out.
Does, if he has a boobometer, that may
two breasts. Okay. One last night it was 9 breasts, and I was like, 9 breasts? And I was like, oh, okay, 9 breasts.
Oh, don't watch that
there
movie.
There was 8, and now there is just 1. Or half of 1.
Oh,
so wow. He's, I don't know if anybody remembers him. If you do, please let me know. But I love people who are funny and break the humor for you when you're watching films on television, because it's hard to watch movies on TV with you know, you're watching something and it's a tone, and next thing you know, like, well, do you need a new car? Well, and it's yeah. like, I don't, it's just like, well, you want somebody lulling you back in to this, the narrative.
You're Sherpa yes. through the story, right? Because I think that,
yes.
I think that one of the things is that we are such distracted or ambient viewers of entertainment or anything. Like, it's so hard to like be, you know, locked into anything that lasts more than like, you know, a half hour to 45 minutes at this point, that it seems like it's an interesting throwback to take something that was a device of BTV.
Yes.
In
yes.
the 80s.
Yes,
you know.
And bring it to now. And I think it's important to do that now. I said something on Twitter a couple of days ago that we're going to go back to a certain kind of intimacy amongst ourselves where we sort of appreciate things in a way that we don't now.
Yeah.
And that's why I like Joe Bob Briggs. Look, he's not PC. He makes stupid comments. They're not aggressive. I mean, it's not like full MAGA, but he's funny.
not full MAGA.
But he's
no, like
no,
dubious.
No, it's not.
I don't know.
I would say it's like 10% MAGA, which is
oh,
fine.
Good.
Yeah, it's okay. Not like 90% MAGA, but like you kind of want somebody to sort of remind you that they have an interest in something and they're consistent and they're passionate.
And that's
and
shared with your interest,
yes.
which is what, for you as a horror yes. buff, just seeing a different point of view or maybe some other kind of point of view.
Yes. And that Alan can watch mm-hmm. because he like enjoys it. Like it mm-hmm. makes him feel like, oh, okay, this is something that we both like. And it's not like super like message.
Ten.
Oh, so I got a message.
No. What are you all about this week?
Kim Joy, who was a contestant on The Great British Bake Off last season. She won the top 3 finalists, and she was my favorite contestant. Mm-hmm. She has a new cookbook that's coming out in September, and it was just up for pre-order, which I definitely hit that button as soon as I found out.
Wow.
And if you don't remember who she was the one that, if it was cute shit, she did it. You know, like she had a space turtle themed cake, and she had a cat yeah. wedding
oh,
cake.
Those, the cat wedding cake,
so
with
fucking
all those
cute.
Tiny cats?
I mean, like the banner said just meowed. I mean, like I know. So I love her, and
and she's Hapa, right?
She is Hapa. Yeah, I think her mother is Malaysian Chinese, and her mm-hmm. father is British. And yeah. I might be getting that wrong, but okay. I think that's
because in the beginning I wasn't sure. Actually, when watching the series, I was like, is she Hapa? Is she just a fan of Asian things?
Yes, I know. I was
Which
also kind of scary.
Very ambiguous,
yes,
right?
Right, right. And I would think the best thing about her was that she could have easily been a stereotype of a mm-hmm. certain type of Asian mm-hmm. girl who's just into cute shit for the sake of being into cute shit. Mm-hmm. And they didn't treat her like that. I mean, I feel like Paul Hollywood came very close to it a few times. But yeah. even then, like, there was a clear respect for her. And she was, you feel like she had done some sort of internal work to be as the person she is today. Like, she's very confident. She is the person that she presented. You feel like she is that person. Like, mm-hmm. she doesn't like cute shit just for the sake of it. Mm-hmm. That truly is a reflection of who she is.
She seems really deeply invested in it. And
yeah.
Like, she's not shy. I mean, she's not also shy in retiring as a shtick at
yes.
all, right?
Yes,
and,
yeah.
But so I wonder, though, do you know, as somebody who has co-written tremendous cookbooks, Do you have any sense of what's actually going to be in it? Is she going to teach us how to make wedding cakes with cats on it?
Yeah, like, I think so. Was it like don't making you want to know how to make that?
So what are some things that you've noticed that she might be making?
Yeah, I think most of it is baking, but I'm not 100% sure. Mm-hmm. There, the Amazon description, I think, is the publisher's description, which is it's 40 recipes with... You know, talk about messaging, little messages of positivity because she's all about that. And I think there's going to be like really cute shaped cakes, you know, like cats jumping that you can decorate if you're into that stuff.
And I assume I need to, what's her name?
Kim Joy.
Because I need to look up and make sure that in my mind, what I think she's, how good she is, she's that good.
Yeah, her creations were really great.
They were, and they were so, but they were also like, they were whimsical as the word that's often used.
Yes.
But also she, it's not just her baking that's
is
like
this
that.
A mm-hmm. real fucking person?
That is that's a real what, exactly. person. Exactly. She is like, basically like.
And she's so comfortable with herself.
And
you
warm.
Know, like, yeah, she just seems like such a wonderful person. And there's like, there's a nerdiness that I really relate to because.
She's a cosplay person. Too,
yeah,
right?
And she met her partner at a board game cafe. I mean, like, it's great.
She's literally a Kewpie doll.
She's like the deep from Nerdistan. Yes, you know, like
so deep.
No, not even talking
she's
about
the mayor.
Her.
Totally fine of it.
She's
you know, like
the
she's just
mayor.
She's totally fine with it.
So, I know that you have a chef in the house, but like, do you bake yourself?
Is this yes, I'm more of a baker than a cook, actually.
Okay,
but
so
I
this
can't
is part
do.
Of what's drawing
yeah,
you.
But I mean, like, it's more like I want to support her first of all because I just know again, just mm-hmm. writing cookbooks. Like how just what that support means, what that buy means for someone and just to support her as who she is. I want to support that. I want more of that in the world.
If I volunteer myself to be someone in the test kitchen when you start making
okay, my
Kim
stuff
Joy's
is not
going
to be as cute because my ability to draw cute things is pretty limited.
Ooh, I just had an idea. We need to have a great Pop Rocket Bake Off.
Oh, yes. For sure. We can have guests involved,
yes,
too.
Yes, yes.
Okay, there we go. Boco for the next Mad
yep.
Fun Drive.
Whoop, whoop.
Okay, so from the nutritious and lovely and whimsical to... the McDonald's of TV watching. I'm tired, people.
Okay.
I said, you know, I recently just announced to the world or to my few followers on Twitter that I am overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
And by overwhelmed, I don't mean I'm so overwhelmed for receiving this Oscar and all of your adoration.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I am busted as fuck.
Yeah.
I can't, Calgon can't take it away.
Nope.
And I'm just like, why are all my machines not in sync? My printer doesn't work. I'm so
is
sad.
Is Mercury still in retrograde?
It's
no,
not.
It's been out for,
it's been out for a couple of weeks.
I
and
think
yet
you
there
got
was
some...
this. That's some bad juju. All that to say, all I have the capacity for right now is some McNugget of entertainment. And that means stumbling upon season frickin' 38 of Survivor.
Oh, boy.
The Edge of Extinction, set in Fiji. And I just, like, the other night, I was up till 4 a.m., like, just watching all the episodes that I hadn't seen so far that aired in the season.
What season are they in now?
38.
Oh, okay,
so
that's the current season.
So which means it's been,
okay.
like, 19 years or whatever, right? Like, that it's been on, essentially.
Because it's on 2 times a year.
It's on twice a year. And part of it is that there are, of course, new players and that there are returning players. And the Edge of Extinction conceit is where, like, basically Survivor has decided to follow that kind of last chance kitchen motif where, like, you end up kind of... you don't completely get kicked out. You have a purgatorial world in which you exist where there's like no rice. You're by yourself. There's nothing. And then as each eliminated player comes, you're just there. And like, you know, and then there's some opportunity to make your way back into the game eventually. And so that is the kind of conceit of it. Again, stolen from cooking competitions.
Right.
And
do you have
things.
To want to go back? Like,
well, you have the choice.
Oh,
so
I see.
Like you
got
leave
it.
The tribal council. You're eliminated. You leave tribal council. And instead of like just going to your exit interview, and there's so many of them are like, I can't wait to have a shower and a burger. And
yeah,
then they get
serious.
To like, yeah, and then they get to this two paths. They're like, if you want your game to end, you can go to this to the right, but if you want to continue, grab this torch and this boat will take you to some weird fucked up place.
Oh, it's like a modern day Robert Frost.
Well, yeah, exactly. And that is kind of how it feels. But I mean, the thing about this format is that it's endlessly compelling, especially when you throw some veterans in the mix. There are very few who are there like four veterans who are mixed in with a other larger group. When you see real gamesmanship happening, it's awesome. You see yourself start rooting for players that you didn't root for before. Like, I'm all freaking Team Kelly, you know, Wentworth right now. Like, I'm so, I mean, nobody remembers if Guy were here. I'm obviously, like, ersatz guying right now by talking about Survivor. But it's just like, you find yourself rooting for certain people that you wouldn't have before. And anyway, it just goes down easy. And there's something about that kind of formula. Mark Burnett, you're evil. You gave us Donald Trump.
He's so fucking evil.
But, you know, the insidiousness of what you do, it's really something to reflect on. On that note, my friends, we're going to take a brief break. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk Killing Eve and Spycraft. After this,
hi, I'm Joe Firestone.
And I'm Manolo Moreno.
And we're the hosts of Dr. Game Show, which is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, regardless of quality or content, with in-studio guests and callers from all over the world.
And you can win a custom magnet. Subscribe now to make sure you get our next episode.
What's an example of a game, Manolo?
Pokemon or medication.
How do you play that?
You have to guess if something's a Pokemon name or medication.
Medication.
First time listener, if you want to listen to episode highlights and also know how to participate, follow Dr. Game Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
We'd love to hear
yeah,
from you.
It's really fun.
For the whole family, we'll be every other Wednesday starting March 13th, and we're coming to Max Fun!
Snorlax.
Pokemon?
Yes.
Nice.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Karen Tongson. With me in the studio,
Winter Mitchell-Rohrbaugh.
Tin Nguyen.
So season two of Killing Eve debuted this past Sunday on BBC America and AMC. We were all very excited. Everybody saw it, right?
Very excited. I was refreshing my BBC America app, actually, all night.
Just waiting all night long?
Just like every hour. I was like, when is it going to come on?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So deep excitement, right?
Very deep.
And so we, as a collective here, wanted to delve deep into what makes the series that's already been picked up for a third season so compelling and so immensely popular. And we wanted to take also a kind of deeper look at, you know, spies in popular culture, or at least situate Killing Eve in relation to that kind of genealogy and history, but mostly to kind of focus on how spies have been portrayed in ways that are unusual or not quite that kind of prototype that we get from that Bondian world. Okay, but we're going to first talk a little bit about season two of Killing Eve, which picks up. Where does it pick up, Tin?
30 seconds after Eve just stabbed Villanelle.
Exactly. So yeah. It's 30 seconds after season one. Sometimes you get big time leaps between seasons. This is a funny little conceit of the second episode. So let's hear a clip from the season one finale to set up that 30 seconds that opens season two.
I think about you all the time. I think about what you're wearing. And what you're doing and who you're doing it with. I think about what friends you have. I think about what you eat before you work or what shampoo you use and what happened in your family. I think about your eyes and your mouth and what you feel when you kill someone. I think about what you have for breakfast. I just want to know everything.
I think about you too. I mean, I masturbate about you a lot.
Ew.
Okay, that too much?
No, that's just, I wasn't expecting that.
The room is collectively fanning itself.
How can you not love the show?
I mean, that is, obviously we do, that's what we're talking about, but it's just like, it is just so, I mean, that deep innuendo that
yes
like, sets
and the up. And the fact that they went there in the first season, because a lot of shows would just draw that out
yeah
for a while
yes
mm-hmm. yeah
yeah and so like you want to say a little bit more about that, so like a lot of shows would draw that out, but the fact that they went specifically to the Eros between these two characters, you want to talk a little bit about that, Tim?
Sure. The fact that they went there, like, you knew what's coming, right? Like, I think if you follow this type of genre, or even if you follow this type of TV show, you know how TV shows work. You know at some point the cat and mouse game, they will meet at some point. And usually that takes seasons, and it just takes forever. It's like whether or not the two main characters in any show are going to get together. You could be like Mulder and Scully and take 9 seasons for it to happen, or what Killing Eve does is that they meet and halfway, they actually meet face-to-face halfway through the first season. And then at the end of the first season, they actually have this mutual confession of love in a way, right? And then,
or at least desire.
Desire, yes. Yes, I shouldn't say love. I should say desire. And then a consummation of that desire in a way with the stabbing. So I think that for a lot of shows, it would take so long to get there. The fact that Phoebe Waller-Bridge takes us there and kind of puts future writers in a spot, like, where do you go from here? It opens up the series to do so many more interesting things than I think you would get from a show that would just draw this cat and mouse game out forever.
It's all about big moves, right? I mean, Winter, you have not, you really didn't watch Killing Eve when it was out. In the beginning, you're a little bit reluctant. I don't know what your hang-up was, girl.
Oh, yeah, why were you reluctant?
But, yeah, so what was your reluctance? And then now that you've decided to dive in, what are some of the things that you've, like, now you're like, how can
someone
like that
show? Why are you putting me on the spot, Katie?
Well, I don't know, because, you know, you were like, I don't know, I'll watch Killing Eve before I watch The Great British Baking Show. I feel like that's a quote.
It's probably
wait
true.
You haven't watched The Great British Bacon Show?
I know you have a lot to discuss with me about, okay? I just, you know what happens is that I get scared by not procedurals, but I get scared by footage.
Okay.
Like, I know if I'm gonna have to, like, get into it, I'm gonna have to get into it. I'm gonna have to know everything about it. I have to be all up in it, and you can't just pull out. Like, you have to just, like, stay involved.
Eve did.
But, like, you know how, like, Game of Thrones, like, you're gonna literally have to go back in time and watch every single episode and follow and read every piece of material about it, including the books, just to be up on what everyone's talking about. So when people try to bring it up with me, like, in a funny way, I'm like, I get upset. I'm like, I know nothing about it and don't even want to start the conversation about it. Don't try to tell me. Don't try to explain. I know about the bloody murder and everybody's heads got cut off. I get it, but I don't care. The thing is that I was wrong. I'm always happy to admit when I'm wrong, and I am sad I didn't get into this when it first came out, because it's a fantastic show.
And what is it that gripped you as somebody who had some reluctance?
Obviously, the queerness.
Well, yeah.
Avi, I think that female relationships are special, whether they're sexual or otherwise. And obviously, I think what I found interesting between there's no expression. She's bisexual. Right, the villanelle, and Eve is in a hetero cishet relationship, but is obviously expressing desire.
Right.
I think that exists in all facets of life, and I like to see it explored in this very. That's about the only thing that's innocent about the whole thing. That's the only thing that lacks deception is this sort of attraction to one another, which I feel like is very. It's nice to watch. It's almost like Jim and Pam.
That's the raw Jim and Pam. That's the raw dynamic of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, given that, you know, given all of that, like, now, like, we're all coming at this from different levels of involvement. What did we think about the season 2 premiere? And it's, you know, basically picking up really hard from where we left off.
Well, I like seeing Villanelle out of her element, which is one thing. And her in the pajamas was fucking hilarious.
That was brilliant.
That was so brilliant, because there is everything you could see when they were packing up her stuff, the fake ambulance drivers, they're packing up her wardrobe in the bag.
Yeah, she was mad.
She was pissed, man. Like,
that
pink dress. Yeah, she was, you could just feel that. So, and then her just being hurt, unable to take care of herself, throwing herself in front of the taxi to get to the hospital. That was hilarious. And just seeing her starting to try to pick up the pieces and still thinking about Eve this whole time. Like, how is she going to get back? When is she going to get back to see her?
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the main hallmarks of the show, really, is that its ability to cut, like, and leaven what is a set of really kind of dark topics and motifs with so much searing humor.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the things that was really noticeable about the season 2 premiere is how funny it was when as a point of fact, is that there are people like dying, getting stabbed. There's a lot of psychological trauma. There's a lot of wreckage.
Right.
But it's just, you know, framed in this completely funny and like accessible way.
Yeah, it's like what she does when she just undercuts the tension of a scene, right? Like, I mean, just talking about that when Eve is coming out after running from Villanelle's apartment, and she's like, she and Carolyn had a very brief chat, and then Carolyn hangs up, and then she says, "I think I might have killed her." And then you cut to she's right in front of this couple, and he, I guess, so he had just a proposal had just happened, and so it's
in
just
a park.
In a park, yeah. So it's like you sort of zoom out on that scene and realize where she is and what's happening, and it's hilarious.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, I mean, in Phoebe Waller-Bridge, you know, one of the things that she says about her writing is this: she's like, and this is a quote, "My instinct is that the more serious the scene, the more I need to undercut it. The element of surprise is the most important thing and what keeps me interested in writing. I can feel it if I've written that predictable or boring line, and I will carry that around me all day." And I think that that is part of the surprise of the show, is the unpredictability around like when the tension will be cut with something that is humorous or twisted. And I do think, though, that for some people that might seem a little bit jarring or like, I don't know, too willfully violent.
But there's so many shows that are just one thing and have been doing that thing forever. I think I mentioned before the show, one, I think The Cut called it a workplace comedy, a psychological thriller, and a cat and mouse spy game. And I'm like, you can get any of those shows on its own.
Right.
And have that. And there's multiples of those. So to have like a primarily, I looked at the credits, something I do now, like how many women were involved in this, mm-hmm. how many people of color were involved in this. And you notice that there's a lot of women involved in the production of the show, even though the source material is written by a man. And I'm like, that's what we want. We deserve layered characters that are not just one thing and might feel something different and might express it in a different way. I want to know about a secret agent and a assassin who actually have like feelings, emotions, concerns, fears, desires.
For women to take a man's text and just to run with it and
yes.
turn it into the thing
yeah.
feels really unique.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, part of that is, and I think this kind of goes back to what Phoebe Waller-Bridge is doing in terms of playing with our expectations, right? Like, one of the reasons why I think the show works so well is because there's such an absence of male gaze.
Yes.
Right? Like, and when you don't have that as much, you open up the show, you open up the script, you open up everything to kind of go in different directions. You can have character development, for example. You can learn that Villanelle likes stickers. You know, it seems like a throwaway characteristic, but it actually is part of her character, and it is a very interesting thing to know.
That she likes stickers.
That she loves stickers. I mean, I don't know, might come up later, but it's just like a weird character trait all of a sudden, you know? And you have room to have that. You have room for characters to breathe in that way. And I think a lot of shows and movies, not just in the spy genre, but in across genres, where they just flip the gender. And that's kind of all they do. They don't mm-hmm. really recognize that the rest of the landscape also changes when you do that. You kind of just put a woman in a masculine coded role and think, well, that's the only thing we need to do with it. But what Killing Eve does is that they actually recognize it and they actually do stuff with it. Like Villanelle is an assassin who is a woman, and there's a recognition that women in society are generally kind of ignored, and so she uses that to her advantage. That's how she kills people. Mm-hmm. And that's also how Eve starts to realize, oh, you know, Villanelle might be a female, like she might be a woman who's assassinating all these mm-hmm. people.
Yeah.
So,
well, let's talk a little bit about that character, Eve Pilastri, and you know, it's unique for multiple reasons. One is that, you know, it's a character named Eve Pilastri, but then that was cast, obviously, as Sandra Oh, and as an Asian woman, right? Where, you know, the ethnicity of that character was, like, I guess, implicitly specified as somebody who's of European descent. But also, like, the journey of that character as a spy or as someone involved in espionage in any way. Because, you know, season one really kicks off with her being a frustrated bureaucrat. And basically one of the things that drops in season two is that, you know, Eve, who was in MI5, which was the kind of domestic security service, kind of like your maybe NSA or Homeland to versus the CIA, finally gets bumped to, you know, Carolyn says, like, well, here's an MI6 situation that you can be a part of, right? Mm-hmm. So she becomes part of the secret foreign intelligence service in the UK, right? Which is what James Bond was a part of, right? So it's kind of like you also see this arc of like spycraft where it's just like somebody who's like a desk jockey, you know, through her own volition and her desire and will, gets herself to that point of espionage or like, you know, or of at least attaining that kind of status of the stuff, the sexy stuff. Right. And, you know, and so that's one of the unique kind of aspects of the show. But how do we see that and like the spying aspects of it, the MI6 aspects of it, the stylistic, we're in the UK, here's this music, here are these dank rooms that we go into. Like, how do we compare that to these other visions of like spydom that we've had? What makes this so accessible or relatable to us?
Eve's clothes. I mean, like when you talk about that sort of like James Bond, for example, I think mm-hmm. that is the most pervasive spy we have in pop culture, the one we keep referencing and the one that kind of overshadows, I think, a lot of spy movies and television shows. But yeah, I mean, he's always fucking dressed right, you know, he's proper everywhere he goes. And Eve, on the other hand, kind of dresses like me, and you know, not a compliment to Eve, but she
looked pretty good.
My girlfriend dressed me today, so that's the only reason. So yeah, I mean, Eve, and this is one reason why Sandra Oh in this character is so great. I mean, she gets to be a little schlubby, right? She gets to just wear like LL Bean type. I don't know what the UK version of LL Bean is. LL Bean,
but
I don't know. Yeah,
but she gets to wear these clothes that are like office clothes, right? And do her spy work, and I think. Carolyn dresses pretty well. You know, you kind of.
Well, that was
you
one
think...
of the questions in the premiere of season two. Is just like, why do you always look so good? Yes, Eve asks Carolyn, why do you always look so good?
And then she says, it's a moisturizer.
But yeah. So the kind of like, so it kind of debunks that.
Yeah, because even though there's a backdrop of glamour, because I think one thing mentioned before was just like the locations are amazing,
fantastic,
beautiful. I mean, just Paris, Tuscany, like they're just beautiful.
Budapest, or wherever.
Yeah, like it's just like, and they actually go to these places to shoot. So there is like a veneer of like this is where things actually happen, where mm-hmm. people live, and mm-hmm. spy things happen there. You know,
spy things happen.
I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, so. So in that backdrop, you have Eve, who doesn't look like what you think a spy might look like. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one way that it is accessible.
Yeah. I think the accessibility for me really was the travel. I know a lot of people probably haven't been to some of these locales, but being able to, and it, like once you're there, you know, they tell you, they put up the slates, Paris, it's Tuscany, whatever, to immediately imbue the energy of the space that they're occupying. And her apartment, I thought, was such a like a throwback. It wasn't like the fanciest Parisian apartment.
Villanelle's apartment?
Yeah, it's not the fanciest, you know. I mean, obviously Eve's is a little bit more updated and modern, but Villanelle's was a little bit more transient, but it had like, she evokes to me that a very coquettish, like 50s, 60s. You don't know much about her. She looks like the beautiful girl walking down a Parisian street with the high, you know, the high street style fashion, not knowing that she's like a murderous psychopath. And I think that it was interesting to show her environment like that. It almost felt like you were walking into something that was out of like the 60s. You know, it was very Renaissance. It was very,
Well, it's super evocative of that, the height of spycraft, or what we think about, like, when we think about, like, represent, like, even that James Bond world, it's like the 60s, it's Cold War, it's like, it's a European city, it's somebody who lives leanly in this place, and, you know, as Eve says in, you know, the premiere of season two, her apartment was chic as fuck. Again, the fantasy of that freedom that I think that Eve projects onto her, like onto Villanelle, it is at once, it's just sort of like in your cat and mouse stuff and in the spy versus spy game.
Yeah.
Like the thing with spy versus spy games in general, like, is that, you know, spies are not, morally pure, right?
Right.
So the they're always compromised and they have to do dubious things.
Which is why I like the test. I don't know the context of her having the guy come in and give the test of showing her the photos and showing her the woman that was hanging and then showing the dog and just trying to check to see if she's, after this latest job, if she's still up to the task, like she handle, is she losing? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I was trying to figure out like what that meant, but I thought, here she is sitting in like combat boots and like this couture pink fluffy dress that is now all the rage and just being like super, super psychopathic. I just, you know, I loved it.
Well, so we talk a little bit about, you know, different innovations around gender in the show. But obviously, you know, Sandra Oh being cast as the female lead and having this Asian female lead, which is, has been big news in entertainment all year and has been like part of the year of like kind of Asians and Asian Americans emerging in popular culture. I wanted to talk to you specifically about this, Tin, because you were working on a project called Asian Women with Amazing Hair.
Right.
And so, and it was related to Killing Eve. And I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about it and what about this show inspired this like kind of queer identitarian project.
Well, the reason why I watched Killing Eve to begin with was because I found out Sandra Oh was cast in it. And then the second reason was because I'm a huge fan of Phoebe Waller-Bridge. But yeah, I mean, when I found out...
So that was your big draw.
I had no idea what the show was about.
You weren't going to watch it until...
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really on my radar. I had no idea. And then I read somewhere that she was in it and she played a lead role and she was going to be, you know, intelligence officer. So like, I'm definitely there. Mm-hmm. And so there's one of the episodes where Villanelle is describing Eve and she describes her as...
Was it an Asian woman with amazing hair?
Sandra Oh's hair, specifically, is definitely its own starring role.
It's a character.
It definitely is. And as an Asian woman with that type of hair, I felt so seen. You know, when Villanelle said that, I was like, oh, that is... I mean, I was struggling with my hair for most of my life. You know, like, I had longer hair at one point. It was curly. It was frizzy. I did not know how to deal with it. Just in general, I'm not good with that stuff. Everybody I went to wanted to cut it short or they wanted to straighten it. And so I did all that actually when I was in like high school and college, and I just didn't know. And at some point, I just gave up and let it flow. And then I finally just cut it. But so to hear Villanelle describe Eve as that, an Asian woman with amazing hair, I was like, oh, that's so, like, I did not know I needed to feel seen that way.
Yes, you know, I love that.
So that's why. So the project I was working on was a Killing Eve podcast. And so it's sort of in production at the moment. It's still ongoing. We did a really great. You were on there once.
I popped in for.
Yeah, it
episode.
Was really great. And hopefully I'll get my stuff together and get it out. So what Sandra Oh, in terms of just seeing her after all these years of her having bit roles, and then, you know, you think, oh, my God, she's on Grey's Anatomy. She's really going to break out after this and start doing other things as well. And to kind of see how the industry treated her and what kind of roles that they thought she could play. And for her to be, you know, just to have enough self-confidence to say, no, I'm not going to do that. Yeah. I'm going to do some other stuff. I'm going to do plays. I'm going to do, you know, she really just... Everything about that I just love.
Yeah.
So.
No, I mean, and also to get to see Villanelle, like one of the key moments, actually that inaugurates their first encounter in season one, is when Villanelle decides to style her, right? When she like basically steals her luggage in Merlin and then like it comes back with all these hot clothes.
What a love
scene. Oh my God.
That is so Kanye. Oh, I love
so
that.
Amazing. I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, mate, oh my God, is Villanelle Kanye?
Is she she has a very Kanye quality.
That
to
is mind blowing, isn't it? Like correlative, actually. I mean, I'm thinking about this stuff too. Like, actually, we had a lot of listener responses to a question that our producers shot out there about like female spy characters and just like some of the things that are compelling. And there's a question from Josh Holtz that I want to pose to the panel here tonight. And it, speaking about wardrobes and sexiness. And Josh asks, culturally, why are spies and sex so inextricable? Is it that spying legit involved a lot of hot sex? Or are we all just swimming in the cultural wake of James Bond, parentheses, ew? So it's true because this, one of the things that's not missing about this, even though like there's not like, there's not a lot of fucking in the show, right? I mean, there's some, like, functional, like, spycraft fucking, right? Where, like, Eve has to pretend to, like, you know, be a dom, or, like you know, like, people use sex in their manipulative ways, but very rarely, much less so than in most spy contexts. What do we think of this question from Josh about, like, why spies and sex are so inextricable?
I feel like the most notable spies that we know, like the Sidney Bristows, the Ethan Hunts, the I had one more in my head that I was going to say, like
James Bond, the Elizabeth Jenningses of the Americans, all of these
they
people.
Use sex as a tool to get what they need to do. And the thing that's always been interesting about Ethan Hunt is he, like, actually falls for his marks, mm-hmm. usually. Mm-hmm. And it, with the exception of one who he ended up marrying, and, like, you know, she follows him through a couple of instances of Mission Impossible. But I think in this sense, we're looking at it a little bit differently because these women both have desires that they can't latch on to because of the work. So, like, when she's banging the guy in that, like, second episode, and she's like, Turbo.
In season one.
As the only cishet one here, I understand what that sex was like.
And then he dies.
And then he dies. Which, if it's really good, that's what happens. I'm sorry about it. No, I'm just thinking, like, you know, she's definitely she's so accustomed to doing it for the purposes of getting to the next part of the journey in order to kill someone or whatever, finish, complete the job, that to actually have an interaction with someone where it could be a love, a potential love interest, is shocking for her. But I feel like spies have always used sex to as a means to get to the next level of the game. And I just think that also the notion that you have to be somebody else allows you to have sex in a way that doesn't have to be anything more than just that. Sex. Right.
Well, one of the things about framing this as a kind of female spy assassin, like cat and mouse game, to a certain extent, and without just capitulating to the male gaze, as you were saying, Tin, is just that it focuses on desire as much as it does sex, mm-hmm. right? So it's just sort of like, yeah, like, sex is the thing that's instrumentalized by assassins occasionally. You know, it's that thing that's a total spy trope, or like a kind of espionage trope, or like, and you know, people use that, as you were saying, to get the things that they want. But the things that both characters want, that both Eve and Villanelle really want, is like the meeting of true minds.
Yes.
You know? And it's just like, and that is just like, and it, that is such a, I think, a kind of gynocentric.
Are you projecting what you have? I feel like you're projecting what you have.
No, but I mean,
I think,
like,
you're projecting, well, Sarah and you onto
well,
this.
But I'm also projecting, like, you know, but like that kind of, like, the kind of fantasy, it's also a fantasy of what Lady on Lady is about. It's just like, it's all like, you know, it's like, I see you, and I see, like, you know, one of the things that Villanelle loves to say is, I know her better than anyone,
right?
And so I do think that that's part of it. I don't know, any thoughts to add to that? Like, Cole, you know, sex versus desire, like, and this is part of what keeps it a different look at the kind of sexuality of the show, which is totally there. Mm-hmm. It's totally, like, in keeping with the spy stuff that we're sort of used to, mm-hmm. but it goes into this other direction.
Well, you know, like, just in queerness, desire is such a queer thing, you know, especially if you are a queer person who's ever lusted or desired somebody who identifies as straight, like, you know what the desire feels like. And then on the other hand, if you are cishet and you all of a sudden find yourself desiring somebody who you don't usually desire, that's also its own interesting desire play right there. And, like, in terms of, like, sex and spies, I think it's interesting with Bond, at least. It's always like a testament to his character that he's so good as a spy that he can manipulate all these women to sleep with him.
Right.
And that's pretty much all he needs to do. Like, for this situation, it is something different. It's not like it's not building character in any particular way. It is purely just the analysis of what desire looks like when it's played out between two women.
Right.
Well, so we've been talking a lot about Sandra Oh, but Linam Maj, one of our listeners, says that personally, I think the real star of Killing Eve is Jodie Comer's Villanelle.
Yeah, she's great.
And so let's talk a little bit, like, let's just a couple words, since I know we're running short on time here in this segment, but like, you know, what do we think of Jodie Comer? I think that, you know, she hasn't gotten as much credit. Like, Sandra Oh got all the attention for the show, and like, and rightfully so, in these award seasons. But Jodie Comer is really freaking amazing in this as well, because it's just like, where did she come from? Who is she? What accent does she really have?
Yes.
You know, like, and how is she at once so terrifying and hot? So,
well, I think you answered that.
You just answered that, yeah. She's terrible. And her style is...
It's impeccable.
It's impeccable.
But also, like that what, you know, and it's sort of dangerous, like somebody who's like that psychopathic, the character that psychopathic, like made so alluring by this figure. And I think that in that sense, that's kind of a reversal of the usual spy narratives of where like the spy is always the hot, indisputably hot person who wiggles their way into many beds. And that
I mean,
kind
they
of
tried right, it with right. Red Sparrow. And the Jennifer Lawrence film,
yeah.
And it the reason that fell flat is because it was gratuitous, and that's mm-hmm. where this show is not. Yeah. It is not gratuitous. It's not playing for just being like showing it to you. They're really asking you to develop with these characters as they go through this journey. Like I think Villanelle is beautiful and mm-hmm. and intriguing, but I'm more concerned about like what how much skill that Eve will obtain while fighting on this journey of self-discovery.
Yeah,
right. I mean, I think what Jodie Comer does so well is that you kind of forget she's a psychopath.
Yeah,
and I was reminded of
even if she's wearing pajamas
and so cute,
creating a little crack that we're not going to spoil for you. But yeah,
like you when she killed Gabriel, for example, like I was not expecting that. Sorry,
yeah.
I was not sorry.
I was. Thank you.
I was not expecting that, and it made me hate her for that second, you know. And I'm like, I'm supposed to hate her.
Right.
She is a psychopath, right? And like, there's something she had told him earlier in the hospital scene where she talks about the stab wound that mm-hmm. she had gotten from Eve, and she says something like, "Sometimes people who are in love do crazy things," and I was like, "Oh my God! If you've been in any relationship where you were battered or there was some sort of abuse or some sort of domestic violence, that's a horrible message, right?" And then you realize, oh, she's a psychopath.
Yeah.
She has fucked up morals,
yeah.
Or she's amoral. She doesn't have morals. She doesn't mm-hmm. know right from wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So that part of, I think her ability to play that is great. So she's great.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, in a way that subtlety, as opposed to almost the overdetermined, like, hot bisexuality of Atomic Blonde, right? Like, which
right.
is another, you know, more recent iteration of like a kind of female espionage thing, even if it was set in like Cold War 80s, is just sort of like, it's sort of a male gaze, prurient, like bisexuality and like, you know, who do I trust? And like, will there be some girl on girl action? And this is just so, again, has different, it has layers.
Yeah. I mean, there's a rejection. The way they treat children in the show is, I think, one of the best things about it. It's just so unsentimental.
The children, yes.
It's so unsentimental.
Let's do that. Yeah.
Right? Like, in the very first episode of the first season, you have Villanelle knocking some ice cream into some kid's
yeah.
face, right?
Yes.
Which is hilarious.
Yeah.
And then the first season, or in the first episode of this season, you have Eve not giving a kid some candy.
Yes. Yeah.
And there's so little sentimentality about children.
Yes.
It's this idea that women should be maternal, all that shit, like, totally out the window.
That
I love.
That is so queer about it. Those little touches, the kind of the little anti-child touches, and that was one of the things I really did. I'm glad you brought it up, because I'm just like, you know, and that's a beautiful symmetry from episode one, season one, to episode one, season two, is just that, like, you know, you expect like that it's going to show us the humanity of these characters,
yeah,
when they respond
right,
to these
right.
cute kids who just want candy or ice cream, which is like, hell no.
And that's mine.
And on that note, my friends, you've been listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, Have you ever watched a movie so bad you just needed to talk to somebody about it?
Well, here at the Flophouse, we watch a bad movie and then talk about it.
Yeah, you don't have to do anything. We'll watch it and we'll talk it. We do the hard work.
Featuring the beautiful vocal talents of Dan McCoy,
Stuart Wellington,
and me, America's Rascal, Elliot Kalin.
New episodes every other Saturday at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts, dude. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Karen Tongson. With me in the studio,
Winter Mitchell-Rabah.
Tin Win.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel that famous question. Those of you who subscribed to Max Fun last year know what it is because you have an enamel pin that says, "What's your current jam?" And so this week, I'm going to ask that question first to our special guest, Tin Win. What is your current jam?
Well, in keeping with the theme, I chose Aretha Franklin's cover of Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Oh, my gosh.
And that she did, she recorded that cover for the movie of the same name, Jumpin' Jack Flash, starring Whoopi Goldberg in 1986. And if you look at it, you look it up on Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 26% rating, which is incorrect.
It is incorrect. Yeah, it's a fun movie.
It's one of the best movies of all time. So Whoopi Goldberg plays an accidental spy. She gets kind of pulled into this whole spy conspiracy.
I love you for this.
And it's a great movie. It's hilarious. It's Penny Marshall's directorral debut, actually. So there's a lot of TV characters in there that she casted. So it's a great show. Aretha's cover is fantastic.
If that isn't an accidental spy song, I don't know what is. And also, it's just like when you describe it as a cover, it's just sort of like, I mean, Aretha covering anything is better than the original, basically. Winter Mitchell-Rabah, what have you got for us this week as a jam?
Real quick, Quadrants heavy. I'm very much into this time of year when it comes to, it's festival season. Coachella starts this weekend, y'all. All right. Not going. Woo! I've aged out. However, I'm still all about it. I started with Tame Impala last week, and now I'm going to Moon Boots. This song is called Keep the Faith by Moon Boots, and I think it is a perfect start to festival season.
So, you know, there's been a lot of, like, bad social media chatter and, like, some rock critic chatter about how Tame Impala, like, and this music right here is just, like, is so yacht rock or whatever. Like, as if that's an insult. And I'm just like, that is the
point.
Beautiful.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing.
Right?
Absolutely,
like, there's
zero.
Something really kind of radiant about this. Like, we need soothing sound.
Yeah,
that's
thank
okay.
You. Thank you, Ten. It's okay.
We need to be reminded of what it feels like to have our toes in a shag rug with a glass of Chardonnay.
If you want to listen to somebody who's been drinking Scissor for a week straight talk about bumbling bullshit, you're more than welcome to do this, but this is my jam. That's why it's called That's My Jam.
That is our jam.
That's my jam.
So my jam is kind of in the spirit of these kind of ambient sounding things that like are a throwback to that softer period. And I am obsessed with the new record by Wiseblood called Titanic Rising. And it just came out April 5th. And this song is the opening track. I'm going to play it for you and I'm going to tell you why I love it so much. I mean,
so nice.
It is, the whole album is this lush, sweeping, sentimental, gorgeous. And part of it, like, it you know, basically Wiseblood is the multi-instrumentalist Natalie Maring, who was an experimental musician and who was originally from PDX. She moved to Philly, now in New York. But this album is so beautiful, and it is giving me both Killing Eve appropriate vibes and, dare I say it, some Karen Carpenter feelings with a dash of Amy Mann. That those strings, the lushness of that kind of alto voice, the overdubbed harmonies, it is so rich and thick. And my friends, a little plug, a little self-promotion, my book is coming out the day that this episode comes out on April 12th. And so I was asked recently in an interview that's about to come out, like, what artists do you think carry the mantle of Karen Carpenter now?
Oh, wow.
That's and that was hard.
That's a hard question.
And I was asked that question before this album came out, so I gave a different answer. But now that this album is out, now that I've spent some time with Wiseblood, I'm just like, no freaking question. This album gives me, like, the promise of what Karen Carpenter could have been in a post-millennial world. And anyway, I love it. I hope you listen to it. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Karen Thompson, with Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh and Tim Nguyen. Our theme music is, as always, Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. And thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. This week, we'd like to thank the people who've murdered Margaret Wappler, because we don't have any new 5-star reviews this week. And guess what? She's not here this week. I think it's your fault. And I'm going to call Margaret as soon as we're done this evening to make sure she's all right, that she's not in some tuberculosis ward. Come on, people. Don't get lazy. I know it's a spring fling out there for you. You're feeling the season. But please get on there and tell us how much you love Pop Rocket. So do you have a comment or question about anything we talked about on this week's show or on any of our recent shows? Give us a call through Guy's Mom at 530-237-4108. And don't forget to call in with who you think should be nominated for the next Pop Rocket Seal of Approval. This is important, folks.
Sandra Oh.
Yeah, see? Ten is already like...
Sandra
Oh.
I'm here.
Yeah, so, you know, this is there's a lot of food for thought here. So think about that. We can be swayed by reason and passion. Again, call 530-237-4108 with your noms. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket. You can find us on Instagram at Pop Rocket Podcast, or join our Facebook group and be part of our discussion. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our senior producer is the happy slappy Laura Swisher.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.